urgency, or in the face of someone else's panic or distress, have a reassuring sense of self-control, enter smoothly into a conversation, and stay effectively involved. In contrast, people who are burdened by their emotions are much less available for whatever the present moment demands. A study of middle and upper-level managers found that those rated best as communicators shared the ability to adopt a calm, composed, and patient manner, no matter what emotional state they were in. They were able to put aside the imperatives of their own feelings, even when turbulent, in order to make themselves fully available for the person they were with. As a result, these managers were able to take the time needed to gather essential information and find a way to be helpful, including giving constructive feedback. Instead of being dismissive or attacking, they tended to be specific about what went right, what went wrong, and how to keep the good things going while fixing what was off. They exercised emotional control, keeping cool so as to stay open to what they were hearing, fine-tuning their responses instead of taking a one-size-fits-all approach. Being socially outgoing and extroverted is not in itself a guarantee of being skilled at communication. And what constitutes effective communication in one culture or social setting can fail miserably in another. Sometimes effective interaction means underplaying one's presence. Among the staff at an elite resort in the southwestern United States, effectiveness correlated negatively with being highly extroverted. In such a posh setting, those who were too loquacious and outgoing were experienced by guests as being intrusive. The guests were there for privacy, so the resort required its staff to be friendly and helpful as needed, but otherwise to be utterly inconspicuous. Conflict management, negotiating and resolving disagreements. People with this competence handle difficult people and tense situations with diplomacy and tact. Spot potential conflict, bring disagreements into the open, and help de-escalate. Encourage debate and open discussion. Orchestrate win-win solutions. A banker wanted to sell a copper company to investors, and he needed a research person expert in mining to write about it so he could convince people in sales to pitch the deal. But the researcher refused outright, upsetting the banker. "I was director of research, so the banker complained to me," says Mark Lohr of Solomon Smith Barney. "I went to the researcher, who told me he was overwhelmed. He was already working 70 to 80 hours a week, had to finish analyses of 18 companies by the end of the month, make 100 phone calls, run off to meetings in Boston, and this report would have taken him another 40 hours to do. After we talked, he went back to the banker and explained how swamped he was, but added, 'If you want me to do it, I will.'" Once the banker understood the researcher's predicament, he decided to find another way to get the job done. But there could have been a blow-up. Everyone is so busy and overwhelmed, their listening abilities dwindle to nothing, and they tend to just assume that no one is as busy as they are, so they make imperious demands. It's so hard to get people to take the time to be good listeners. It's not just about being nice. Until you're a good enough listener, until you can sense what the other person is going through, you won't be able to make a reasonable suggestion, to come up with something they'll buy. One talent of those skilled at conflict resolution is spotting trouble as it is brewing and taking steps to calm those involved. Here, as Laura points out, the arts of listening and empathizing are crucial. Once the investment banker understood the researcher's perspective, he became more accommodating, and the conflict ended. Such diplomacy and tact are qualities essential for success in touchy jobs like auditing, police work, or mediation, or any job where people depend on each other under pressure. One of the competencies sought in tax auditors by the U.S. government is the ability to present an unpopular position in a way that creates little or no hostility and preserves the other person's sense of dignity. The word for this skill is tact. At American Express, the ability to spot potential sources of conflict, take responsibility for one's own role, apologize if need be, and engage openly in a discussion of each person's perspective is prized in their financial advisors. Reading the signs. Charlene Barshefsky had finally gotten the Chinese government, after months and months of negotiation, to agree to clamp down on the piracy of American movies, compact discs, and computer software. How? Barshefsky had refused to accept their final offer, just another in an ongoing series, all of which he felt were inadequate. But this time, the head of the Chinese delegation thanked her for her work, told her he would respond at a later date, and then moved his shoulders back in a slight shrug. That simple and subtle gesture indicated she had won their cooperation. Barshefsky had been closely studying the faces across the table from her that day, and she had sensed far less acrimony than before in the endless, tedious meetings. That day, reactions were muted and questions few, a striking change from the combative, sharply challenging dialogue that had marked the early rounds of the negotiations. Barshefsky's reading of those subtle signals proved right. That was the day the Chinese delegation stopped fighting and started moving toward the trade agreement the countries later signed. The ability to read the feelings of the opposition during a negotiation is critical to success. As one of my lawyers, Robert Friedman, says about negotiating contracts, "It's mainly psychological. Contracts are emotional. It's not just what the words say, but how the parties think and feel about them that matters." Those who have mastered the art of the deal realize the emotionally charged nature of any negotiation. The best negotiators can sense which points matter most to the other party and gracefully concede there, while pressing for concessions in points that do not carry such emotional weight. And that takes empathy. Skill at negotiation obviously matters for excellence in professions like law and diplomacy. But to some extent, everyone who works in an organization needs these abilities. Those who can resolve conflict and head off trouble are the kind of peacemakers vital to any organization. In a sense, a negotiation can be seen as an exercise in joint problem solving, since the conflict belongs to both parties. The reason for the negotiation, of course, is that each side has its own competing interests and perspective, and wants to convince the other to capitulate to its wishes. But the very act of agreeing to negotiate acknowledges that the problem is a shared one, and that there may be a mutually satisfying solution available. In this sense, negotiation is a cooperative venture, not just a competitive one. Indeed, as Herbert Kelman, a Harvard psychologist who specializes in negotiations, points out, the process of negotiation itself restores cooperation between conflicting parties. Solving their problems together transforms their relationship. That resolution requires that each side be able to understand not just the other's point of view, but their needs and fears. This empathy, Kelman observes, makes each side better able to influence the other to their own benefit by being responsive to the other's needs. In other words, to find ways in which both parties can win. Negotiating channels. Negotiations, mostly informal, happen all the time. Take the negotiation between a manufacturer and the retail stores that sell its products, like this one. "I've been cut off from carrying one of our main lines of women's jewelry," a boutique owner explained. "I wanted to negotiate a better deal with the distributor. We've been a good outlet for them. But he got a better offer from a store across town. So I made a counterproposal. But the other store got the account, and the company only wants one outlet in a town this size. So now I'm out of luck." Such channels of distribution are essential for manufacturers' very survival, just as the retailers depend on the manufacturers for their stock. But each party has an array of choices. The result is an ongoing negotiation over such issues as how large markups will be, the terms of payment, and timeliness of deliveries. Most channel relationships are long-term and symbiotic. And in any long-term relationship, problems simmer and boil to the surface from time to time. When they surface, those involved on either side of manufacturer-retailer disputes typically use one of three styles of negotiation. Problem-solving, in which both parties try to find the solution that works best for each side. Compromise, where both parties give in more or less equally regardless of how that serves their needs. And aggression, where one party forces unilateral concessions from the other side. In a survey of retail buyers in department store chains, each of whom handled merchandise worth $15 million to $30 million, The style of negotiating was an accurate barometer of the health of the manufacturer-retailer relationship. Predictably, when negotiations were typically aggressive, revolving around threats and demands, it boded poorly for the future of the relationship. Buyers ended up embittered and dissatisfied, and often dropped the product line. But for those relationships in which aggressiveness was ruled out in favor of problem-solving or compromise, the longevity of the relationship increased. Threats and demands poison the waters of negotiation. Even when one party is far more powerful than the other, a magnanimous spirit may be a winning strategy in the long run, particularly when the parties will have continued dealings. And this is why, even when a retailer was completely dependent on a single manufacturer, negotiations were most often non-coercive, given the desire for a long-term relationship and their mutual dependence. A spirit of cooperation always works best. Resolving conflict creatively. One evening, Linda Lantieri was walking down a desolate, dangerous block, lined with abandoned, boarded-up buildings, when suddenly, out of nowhere, she was surrounded by three boys, about 14 years old. One pulled out a knife with a 4-inch blade as they pressed in around her. "Give me your purse now," the boy with the knife hissed. Though frightened, Lantieri had the presence of mind to take some deep breaths and reply coolly, "I'm feeling a little uncomfortable. You know, guys, you're a little into my space. I'm wondering if you could step back a little." Lantieri studied the sidewalk, and, to her amazement, she saw three pairs of sneakers take a few steps back. "Thank you," she said, then continued. "Now, I want to hear what you just said to me, but to tell you the truth, I'm a little nervous about that knife. I'm wondering if you could put it away." After what seemed an eternity of silence and uncertainty, the knife went back into a pocket. Quickly reaching into her purse, Lantieri took out a $20 bill, caught the eye of the one with the knife, and asked, "Who should I give it to?" "Me," he said. Glancing at the other two, she asked if they agreed. One of the two nodded. "Great," she said, handing the leader the $20 bill. "Now here's what's going to happen. I'm going to stay right here while you walk away." With puzzled looks on their faces, the boys slowly started to walk away, glancing over their shoulders at Lantieri. And then they broke into a run. They were running from her. In a sense, that small miracle of turning the tables is no surprise. Lantieri is the founder and director of the New York City-based Resolving Conflict Creatively program, which teaches these skills in schools. Lantieri has immersed herself in the crafts of negotiation and handling conflict amicably. While she earned her trade as a teacher, for a while in a Harlem school not far from that desolate block, she now trains others in more than 400 schools throughout the United States. Lantieri does more than just promote education and conflict resolution. She first convinces skeptical school boards to approve her program. In fact, when the school board of one California town was paralyzed by two bitterly bickering factions, both sides were so impressed by her negotiating skills, they asked Lantieri to come in and help them heal the split. Lantieri's maestro performance on the street illustrates some classic moves for cooling down conflicts. First, calm down, tune into your feelings, and express them. Show a willingness to work things out by talking over the issue, rather than escalating it with more aggression. State your own point of view in neutral language, rather than in an argumentative tone. Try to find equitable ways to resolve the dispute, working together to find a resolution both sides can embrace. These strategies parallel those espoused for win-win solutions by experts at Harvard Center for Negotiation. But while following these strategies may seem simple, implementing them as brilliantly as Lantieri did requires the prerequisite emotional competencies of self-awareness, self-confidence, self-control, and empathy. Remember, empathy need not lead to sympathetically giving in to the other side's demands. Knowing how someone feels does not mean agreeing with them, but cutting off empathy to hold a hard line can lead to polarized positions and deadlocks. Leadership. Inspiring and guiding individuals and groups. People with this competence articulate and arouse enthusiasm for a shared vision and mission. Step forward to lead as needed, regardless of position. Guide the performance of others while holding them accountable. Lead by example. Here's an extraordinary instructive contrast in leadership. Ronald W. Allen, former CEO of Delta Airways, and Gerald Grinstein, a former CEO of Western Airlines and the Burlington Northern Railway. Grinstein, a lawyer by training, is a virtuoso at establishing rapport with his employees and using that emotional attunement to persuade. As CEO of Western Airlines, an ailing company when he took it over in 1985, he spent hundreds of hours in cockpits, behind check-in counters, and in the baggage handling pits getting to know his employees. The rapport he built was crucial in convincing Western Airlines' workforce to agree to concessions on work rules and to take pay cuts, all for his promise of a solvent company in which they would have a bigger stake. With those concessions in hand, Western Airlines landed solidly in the black, and Grinstein was able to sell the airline to Delta for $860 million after just 2 years. In 1987, he became CEO of Burlington Northern, another money-losing company, and again, Grinstein worked his interpersonal magic. He flew a selected group of maintenance workers, secretaries, and train crews from all over the country to company headquarters in Fort Worth to dine with him. He rode the railroad's routes and talked with crews, all the while working successfully toward convincing them to buy into his cost-cutting plans. A close friend of Grinstein observed of his leadership style, "You don't have to be an SOB to be tough." Though the railroad was laden with $3 billion in debt when he took it over, Grinstein turned it around. And in 1995, he created the largest U.S. rail network when Burlington Northern bought Santa Fe Pacific. Now let's look at Ronald W. Allen, who was fired by his board as CEO of Delta Airlines in April of 1997, even as the company was enjoying record profits. Allen had moved up through the ranks to become CEO in 1987, taking the helm just as the airline industry was deregulated. His strategic plan was to become more globally competitive. In 1991, he bought just bankrupt Pan American World Airways for access to its European routes. That turned out to be a miscalculation, loading Delta with a huge debt burden just as the industry saw profits plummet. Delta, always profitable in the past, plunged $500 million more into debt over each of the 3 years following the Pan Am purchase. However, it was not this disastrous financial decision that cost Allen his job. Allen reacted to the hard times by becoming a tough, almost ruthless boss. He gained a reputation for humiliating underlings by berating them in front of other employees. He silenced opposition among top executives, even moving to replace the chief financial officer, the one person who had openly disagreed with him on the acquisition of Pan Am. Another top executive with whom Allen had competed to become CEO announced he was leaving to become president of Continental Airlines, and Allen is said to have responded by demanding the keys to the executive's company car on the spot, leaving him to find another way home. Such pettiness aside, Allen's main failing was his heartless downsizing. Allen hacked away 12,000 jobs, about a third of the total Delta workforce. Some positions fat, no doubt, but many others the muscle, sinew, and nerves of the organization. With the deep cuts came a precipitous drop in the airline's once enviable customer service ratings. Complaints about Delta suddenly skyrocketed, everything from dirty planes and late departures to missing baggage. Allen had squeezed the spirit out of the company, along with the fat. Delta employees were in shock. The company had never treated them so harshly before. Insecurity and anger were rampant. Even after the cuts put the airline into the black again, a company-wide survey of the 25,000 remaining employees revealed a skeptical, frightened workforce with half hostile to Allen's leadership. In October 1996, Allen publicly admitted that his draconian cost-cutting campaign had had devastating effects on Delta's workforce. But his comment was, "So be it." And that became the battle cry for the employees' protest. Pins with the phrase, "So be it," sprouted on the uniforms of pilots, flight attendants, and mechanics alike. With Allen's contract up for renewal, the Delta board looked beyond the numbers to the overall health of the company. Delta's reputation for outstanding service was tarnished. talented managers were leaving the company. And, worst of all, morale among employees was abominable. So the board, led by none other than Gerald Grinstein, acted. Allen, the man whose power had once been so great that he held the titles of chairman, CEO, and president, was out at age 55, largely because he was killing the company's soul. Leadership as giving energy. The twin tales of Robert W. Allen and Gerald Grinstein demonstrate that the art of leadership lies in how a person implements change, not just in the change itself. Both men went through the painful process of cutting costs, but one did so in a way that kept employees' loyalty and spirits high, while the other demoralized and alienated an entire workforce. The artful leader is attuned to the subtle undercurrents of emotion that pervade a group and can read the impact of his or her own actions on those currents. One way leaders establish their credibility is by sensing these collective, unspoken feelings and articulating them for the group, or acting in a way that tacitly shows they are understood. In this sense, the leader is a mirror, reflecting back to the group its own experience. However, the leader is also a key source of the organization's emotional tone. The excitement emanating from a leader can move an entire group in that direction. As Birgitta Wistrand, the CEO of a Swedish company, put it, "Leadership is giving energy." This transmission of emotional energy lets leaders be the pilots of an organization, setting its course and direction. For example, when Lou Gerstner was brought in as CEO of IBM, he knew he had to transform the culture of the company to save it. "And that," Gerstner said, "is not something you do by writing memos. You've got to appeal to people's emotions. They've got to buy in with their hearts and bellies, not just their minds." The ability of leaders to get that buy-in hinges in part on how emotions flow within a group. We've already seen how emotions spread from the most expressive person in a group. But this ability to transmit emotions is amplified for leaders, since people in groups spend more time looking at the leader than at anyone else. This attention magnifies the impact of the leader's mood on the group. A small change in the facial expression or tone of voice of a powerful figure can have more impact than dramatic shows of feeling by someone in a lesser position of power. People not only pay more attention to leaders, they also tend to mimic them. Lore has it that at Microsoft, people rock back and forth as they are pondering or arguing a point in a meeting, a nonverbal homage to Bill Gates's habit. Such mimicry is an unconscious way of showing allegiance and attunement to the most powerful person in a group. During his presidency, Ronald Reagan was known as the great communicator. A professional actor, the emotional power of Reagan's charisma was shown in a study of how his facial expressions affected those of his listeners during an election debate with his opponent, Walter Mondale. When Reagan smiled, people who watched him, even on videotape, tended to smile too. When he frowned, so did viewers. Mondale, who lost the election, had no such emotional impact, even on viewers who were sympathetic to his views. The ease with which emotions spread from a leader through the group has a downside too. As the old saying holds, a fish rots from the head down. Brutish, arrogant, or arbitrary leadership demoralizes a group. Birgitta Wistrand uses the term emotional incontinence for the leakage of destructive emotions from the top down. With disturbing emotions, a leader saps other people's energy by making them anxious, depressed, or angry, she says. On the other hand, extremely successful leaders exhibit a high level of positive energy that spreads throughout the organization. And the more positive the mood of a group leader, the more positive, helpful, and cooperative are those in the group. In general, emotional charisma depends on three factors: feeling strong emotions, being able to express those emotions forcefully, and being an emotional sender rather than a receiver. Highly expressive people communicate through their facial expression, their voice, their gestures, their whole body. This ability allows them to move, inspire, and captivate others. The ability to convey emotion convincingly from the heart requires that a leader be sincere about the message being delivered. Truly believing the emotional message is what separates the charismatic leader from the self-serving manipulative one. Manipulative leaders may be able to play act for a time, but they can less readily convince followers of their sincerity. Cynicism undermines conviction. To be a charismatic messenger, the leader must act from authentic belief. The Leader's Competence Toolkit. Each emotional competency interacts with others. This applies to the leadership competence more than most. The task of the leader draws on a wide range of personal skills. My analysis of myriad jobs found that emotional competence makes up about 2/3 of the ingredients of star performance in general. But for outstanding leaders, emotional competencies, as opposed to technical or cognitive cues, make up 80 to 100% of those listed by companies themselves as crucial for success. Matthew Schechter, chairman of the American Society for Training and Development, agrees. Leadership is almost all emotional intelligence, especially in distinguishing between what managers do and what leaders do. Things like taking a stand, knowing what's important to you, pursuing your goals in partnership with others. For the most effective CEOs, there are three main clusters of competence. The first two fall under the emotional intelligence heading. The first includes personal competencies like achievement, self-confidence, and commitment, while the second consists of social competencies like influence, political awareness, and empathy. This broad band of capabilities typified high-performing CEOs in Asia, the Americas, and Europe, suggesting the traits of outstanding leaders transcend cultural and national boundaries. The third cluster of competencies in the CEOs was cognitive. They think strategically, seeking out information with a broad scan, and apply strong conceptual thinking. As with the analysis of leaders in 15 major corporations in Chapter 2, what distinguished standouts was the ability to see the big picture, to recognize telling patterns amidst the clutter of information, and to think far into the future. But great leaders go a step further, integrating emotional realities into what they see, and so instilling strategy with meaning and resonance. Their emotional intelligence allows the blending of all of these elements into an inspired vision. The best leaders, says Robert E. Kaplan of the Center for Creative Leadership, have an almost magical ability to turn a phrase and articulate their agenda for the organization graphically, compellingly, memorably. In other words, leadership entails exciting people's imaginations and inspiring them to move in a desired direction. It takes more than simple power to motivate and lead. Nice guys finish first. An analysis of the power of a leader to set a positive or negative emotional tone in an organization was undertaken within the U.S. Navy, where the standards for superior performance are cut and dried. Annual awards are given to the most efficient, safest, and most prepared squadrons. In an extensive comparison of superior and just average commands, a striking difference in the emotional tone the commanding officer set was revealed. The very best commands, it turned out, were run not by Captain Ahab types, who terrorized their crews, but by, well, nice guys. The superior leaders managed to balance a people-oriented personal style with a decisive command role. They did not hesitate to take charge, to be purposeful, assertive, and businesslike. But the greatest difference between average and superior leaders was in their emotional style. The most effective leaders were more positive and outgoing, more emotionally expressive and dramatic, warmer and more sociable, including smiling more, friendlier and more democratic, more cooperative, more likable and fun to be with, more appreciative and trustful, and even gentler than those who were merely average. By contrast, the mediocre Navy leaders reflected the classic stereotype of the military taskmaster. They were legalistic, negative, harsh, disapproving, and egocentric. Compared to the superior commanders, the average ones were more authoritarian and controlling, more domineering and tough-minded, more aloof and self-centered, and needed to show they were right more often. They led by the book, through the rules and the assertion of the raw power of their position. And it did not work, even in the military, where this emotional style might seem to find its natural home. The leadership ripple effect. The emotional tone set by any leader ripples downward with remarkable precision. When successive levels from top to bottom of an organization are analyzed, the effect is very much like a set of Russian dolls, one stacked inside the other, with the leader containing all the rest. This is most easily seen in military hierarchies, where, as was found in the Navy study, the most effective leaders were warm and outgoing, emotionally expressive, democratic, and trusting. And so were leaders on down through the ranks, though not to the same extent as the top commander. By contrast, less effective officers were harsher and more disapproving, distant and irritable, legalistic and uncooperative, and so their subordinates were also. While average leaders tend to be invisible, the best leaders frequently walk around and strike up conversations with their staff, asking about their families and other personal matters. They also let it be known that they want to be informed, creating an atmosphere of openness that makes it easier for communication to take place. This two-way channel encourages people at all levels to keep their superiors informed. In mediocre military commands, junior-level people were reluctant to send news upward, especially bad news, because the top commanding officer so often went ballistic when given bad news, and instead of delegating authority to the lowest possible level, stepped in to micromanage. To be sure, the best officers were highly task-oriented and firm in swiftly reprimanding people whose actions threatened performance standards, but they were flexible when it came to trivial rules. The mediocre commanders made no distinction between meaningful and trivial regulations, holding instead to a legalistic, inflexible standard that did nothing to boost morale or performance. Realizing that unity and cohesiveness are built from personal bonds, the best officers organize downtime events like softball games and awards celebrations, and make a point of attending themselves. From this shared downtime, with the attendant in-jokes and warm social climate, comes a strong sense of shared identity, which in turn pays off in superior on-the-job performance. By contrast, the mediocre officers are more concerned with whether the equipment is functioning than they are with their people. When to be tough. To be sure, leadership does demand a certain toughness, at times. The art of leadership entails knowing when to be assertive. For example, confronting someone directly about their performance lapses, and when to be collegial and use less direct ways to guide or influence. Leadership demands tough decision-making. Someone has to tell people what to do, hold people to their obligations, be explicit about consequences. Persuasion, consensus building, and all the other arts of influence do not always do the job. Sometimes it comes down to simply using the power of one's position to get people to act. A common failing of leaders, from supervisors to top executives, is the failure to be emphatically assertive when necessary. One obstacle to such assertiveness is passivity, as can happen when someone is more concerned with being liked than with getting the job done right, and so tolerates poor performance rather than confronting it. People who are extremely uncomfortable with confrontation or anger are also often reluctant to take an assertive stance, even when it is called for. Incompetence here can show up in something as commonplace as failing to take the helm in a meeting, and so letting it meander rather than steering it directly to key agenda items. Another deficiency in leadership in this area is the inability to be clear and firm. This results in workers not knowing what's expected of them. One sign of an assertive leader is the ability to say no firmly and definitively. Another is to set an expectation of high standards for performance or quality and insist people meet them, even publicly monitoring performance if necessary. When people fail to perform, the leader's task is to give helpful feedback rather than let the moment and the lapse go unnoted. And when someone consistently performs poorly, despite all attempts at helpful feedback and development, the lapse has to be confronted directly and openly. Take the manager who says, "My predecessor didn't establish any discipline about meetings. The first meeting I ran, people straggled in late and weren't prepared. So when it happened a third time, I put my foot down. I said, 'Ladies and gentlemen, I can't accept this behavior. I'm postponing this meeting for 2 days. Be on time and be prepared, or there'll be hell to pay.'" This does not describe the petty tyrant or office bully, however. This is a strategy that comes into play only when other, less severe approaches have failed, not as a first response. If the tone described above typifies a manager's everyday style, then there is something wrong with her abilities to build rapport and influence people. In other words, constant toughness is a sign of weakness, not a sign of strong leadership. The glorification of leaders who are oafish, arrogant, and brash ignores the cost to the organization. To be sure, a certain decisiveness in making hard decisions is necessary. But if that decision is carried out with imperious ruthlessness, the boss who did it will end up hated and a failure as a leader. During hard times, leaders need to call on whatever reserve of goodwill they may have built up over time. This is when the Attila the Huns are often undone. At our company, one manager was pushy and abrasive, even resented by his people, but he got things done. Muhammad Amin Kashgari, an executive vice president at the Savola Company, Saudi Arabia's largest food manufacturer, told me. But when things changed and the market got tougher, and we all had to work harder to maintain our market share, he added, that manager's autocratic style defeated him. The star manager that emerged then was someone people liked and who inspired everyone to work harder. But the imperious manager just kept pushing in the same old way, and his people abandoned him. Having the ability to keep raw, unrestrained lust for power under control is one mark of a mature leader. A classic long-term study at AT&T found that, particularly in large organizations, managers who combined self-control with the ability to have a high impact were promoted as time went on, while those who had great impact but lacked the basics of self-control foundered. In top-performing managers and executives, the drive of personal ambition is held in check by strong self-control and focus toward collective goals. The virtual leader. It's a fogged-in, desperate day at the San Francisco airport. Flight after flight is being canceled, and the lines at the airline service desks are snaking out of sight. Tension has been building by the hour, with people sniping at the airline representatives and at each other. David Kolb, a professor of management at Case Western Reserve University, who tells this story, decided to try to change the mood of the mob, at least of those near him. So he announced, "I'm going to get some coffee. Anyone else want some?" He took down orders from a building chorus of frustrated fellow passengers, trundled off, and returned with a stack of drinks. And that was enough to trigger a rippling cascade of good feeling. Kolb, at that moment, emerged as the natural leader of this inchoate group. His spontaneous rise speaks to the fluid nature of leadership itself. Someone's formal position on the organizational chart and her actual role as leader don't always match up. People may come forward to take a leadership role for a time, as some special need arises. It can be something as small as taking a supplier to task for a sloppy job, then fade back into the group. Such assertiveness can also be directed upward, as when a lower-level employee challenges a higher-level one on difficult issues or truths vital to the well-being of the organization. For instance, higher-ups at an oil company that was establishing offices in a South American city chose to rent space in a brand-new high-rise tower in the most expensive part of town. But the manager of that branch, when talking with a local minister, was told sarcastically, "That sounds like something a company like yours would do." Puzzled, the manager asked around and finally realized that locating their offices in that part of town had sent a message that the company was more interested in making an impression than in doing business. With that information in hand, he took it upon himself to abandon the original plan and look for offices in a growing business district, a location that would send the signal they were serious. Then he called his bosses back in the United States and told them what he had done and why. His boss's response, "We disagree with you, but we're not down there. You decide what's best." Such a move, of course, requires self-confidence and initiative, both emotional competencies essential to leadership. The surfacing of such virtual leaders is becoming a standard mode of operating in high-tech fields, where very junior people may be very senior in terms of newly emergent areas of expertise. At Finland's Nokia Telecommunications Group, about 70% of the employees are engineers, with an average age of 32. A large percentage of these engineers are fresh out of university and are more familiar with newer technologies than are their 40-ish bosses. Veli-Pekka Niitamo, head of competence management and recruitment there, says, "We've redefined the nature of leadership. Everyone has leadership. A young engineer takes leadership as necessary. Our model is that you are your own boss inside the Nokia world. The old static structure of managers and subordinates is outdated." Indeed, all static structures are outdated in today's business climate, which gets us to the next competence, leading change. Change catalyst, initiating or managing change. People with this competence recognize the need for change and remove barriers. Challenge the status quo to acknowledge the need for change. Champion the change and enlist others in its pursuit. Model the change expected of others. The personal epiphany came late in 1993 for John Patrick, and it took him just 24 months to transform that inspired insight into company policy. The company is IBM. 1993 marked the year Lou Gerstner came to the helm and began the organization's turnaround. But massive, deep change happens not just from the top down. In Patrick's case, his mini-revolution was a grassroots victory. It all revolved around the Internet. That day in 1993, Patrick, then a senior strategist for the company, was fiddling with a program called Gopher, an Internet software utility. As he tells it, "I became captivated by the idea of sitting at home and cruising around in someone else's computer. Being remotely connected was hardly a new idea at IBM. But being inside someone else's computer, no matter what kind of computer either of us had, a light went off." At that point, IBM was a company focused on computer hardware. The burgeoning Internet was beneath its radar, and the company had virtually no products or plans for the web. Gerstner was about to change that. But it was people like Patrick, dispersed throughout the company, who made it reality. Patrick created the manifesto, Get Connected, in which he argued that Internet-like connections would reinvent the nature of organizations, industries, and work. He offered some practical suggestions to buttress his idea. Give an email address to everyone in the organization. Encourage news groups within the company in order to build communities of mutual interest. And put up an IBM website. While those ideas are widely accepted now, at the time, and especially at IBM, they were radical. But the audience was there, spread throughout the company. As soon as he distributed his manifesto, Patrick started hearing from people by fax, email, and phone from every corner of IBM. So Patrick started a mailing list and used it to stitch together a kind of virtual organization within IBM that cut across its formal groups. The members of this new group were from around the world. They had no formal status, authority, or budget. And though they were still undetected by the organizational radar, they got things done. Their first project was up and running by May 1994. It involved putting up IBM's company website, one of the first such by any major corporation. That same month, Patrick committed the company to participate in the next Internet World Forum without permission from IBM. This moment of risk-taking took courage and vision, and perhaps a bit of simple faith as well. That faith paid off. Patrick approached various divisions of the company for funding, collecting $5,000 here, $5,000 there. And by the time Internet World rolled around, 54 people from 12 different units had signed on to represent IBM. The effort still had no formal status within the company, nor any budget. But with this momentum, IBM developed a formal Internet strategy, convened a task force, and created its Internet division. That division came into being on December 1, 1995. Its task, defining and pursuing the company's internet initiatives, was to be led by John Patrick, Vice President in charge and Chief Technology Officer. What was once a loose-knit virtual team was now a formal division with 600 people. One of its projects was a wildly successful website for the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta. The site averaged 11 million hits each day. The IBM team, using software and development to handle all that traffic, found the experience a natural R&D opportunity. They realized that they had developed software that could handle massive amounts of traffic and rolled it over into what became commercial software, one of many product lines for the net that are the fruit of Patrick's original epiphany. The change catalyst, key ingredients. Today, organizations are reshuffling, divesting, merging, acquiring, flattening hierarchies, going global. The acceleration of change through the 1990s has made the ability to lead it a newly ascendant competence. In earlier studies in the 1970s and 1980s, being a change catalyst was not highly valued. But as we approach the millennium, more and more companies are putting a premium on people who can lead through change. What are the qualities that make someone an effective change catalyst? When we work with a company to help them transform their business, the personal abilities of the leader of their team counts immensely. John Ferreira, a partner at Deloitte & Touche Consulting, tells me, say we're helping them cut the time it takes to fill orders. To do that, you have to work across the separate silos of the organization, and you need someone who's not at too high a level. Not a theorist, but someone with enough hands-on expertise that they're close enough to what's going on that they can cut across all the functions involved and see the real situation. It's often a second-level manager. Beyond technical expertise, the change catalyst needs a host of other emotional competencies. You want the kind of second-level manager who has the ability to go into a vice president's office and lay on the table what that VP needs to do, without being intimidated by the fact that he's just a second-line manager, Ferreira adds. For example, at a large financial services company going through the turmoil of deregulation and a newly competitive market, the leaders who were most confident in their abilities led divisions that flourished despite the changes. In addition to high levels of self-confidence, effective change leaders have high levels of influence, commitment, motivation, initiative, and optimism, as well as an instinct for organizational politics. As Ferreira puts it, you need someone who takes this as a mission, not just a job, who is passionate about the change, gets up in the morning thinking about it. It's something like the difference between a renter and an owner. Owners are dedicated. That's crucial, because it also takes perseverance. You get lots of smokescreens thrown up, lots of resistance. You need to know how to use us, the consultants, to help make your case to the right people at the right time. And you have to keep presenting your case, building coalitions of support, until you reach a critical mass that gets it over the top. The transformational leader. Change leaders are not necessarily innovators. While leaders recognize the value of a new idea or way of doing things, they often are not the ones who originated the innovation. For organizations riding the waves of change, and what organization is not these days, traditional management is not enough. In times of transformation, a charismatic, inspiring leader is called for. The model of transformational leadership goes beyond management as usual. Such leaders are able to rouse people through the sheer power of their own enthusiasm. Such leaders don't order or direct. They inspire. In articulating their vision, they are intellectually and emotionally stimulating. They show a strong belief in that vision, and they excite others about pursuing it with them. And they are committed to nurturing relationships with those they lead. Unlike more rational modes of leadership, in which leaders use standard rewards like pay and promotions to encourage their workers, the transformational leader goes to another level, mobilizing people for organizational change by arousing their emotions about the work they do. In doing so, such leaders appeal to people's sense of meaning and value. Work becomes a kind of moral statement, a demonstration of commitment to a larger mission that affirms people's sense of sharing a valued identity. Doing this requires the leader to articulate a compelling vision of the new organizational goals. Even though the goals may be somewhat utopian, committing to them can be emotionally satisfying in itself. Arousing people's emotions in this way and harnessing them in pursuit of lofty or noble goals gives a leader a powerful force for change. Indeed, studies show that this kind of leadership brings greater efforts and better performance from subordinates, making their work more effective. The emotional craft. A test of this transformational leadership style came at a large Canadian financial services company that was struggling with immense turbulence and high levels of uncertainty brought on by deregulation. What had once been a staid and successful company in a protected market now had to be nimble to keep a place in a market it had once dominated. A group of senior managers from the company's top four levels were followed for a year as they led their units through these chaotic times. At the end of that period, each was evaluated in terms of productivity improvement, premium income, and salary-to-budget ratio. There was a wide range of success. Some leaders met as little as 17% of the targeted goals, while others achieved up to 184% of the targets. Those who relied on the transformational style had the greatest success. Indeed, those who practiced standard management were seen as trying to control and restrict workers. The successful leaders were rated by people who worked for them as highly charismatic and flexible. They seemed to spread their own sense of confidence and competence, and they inspired people to be more imaginative, adaptive, and innovative. This study echoes what John Kotter, a Harvard Business School leadership expert, cites as the difference between management and leadership. In the way he uses the words, management refers to the ways complex enterprises are kept orderly, non-chaotic, and productive. Leadership, by contrast, refers to effectively handling the changes that the competitiveness and volatility of the times have wrought. As Kotter puts it, motivation and inspiration energize people, not by pushing them in the right direction as control mechanisms, but by satisfying basic human needs for achievement, a sense of belonging, a feeling of control over one's life, and the ability to live up to one's ideals. Such feelings touch us deeply and elicit a powerful response. Leadership of this kind, then, is an emotional craft. Chapter 9. Collaboration, Teams, and the Group IQ. None of us are as smart as all of us. Japanese proverb. It was a seminal moment in the early history of Silicon Valley. At a 1982 meeting of the Silicon Valley Computer Club, with hundreds of engineers packing the room, a writer for the San Jose Mercury asked the assembly, "How many of you plan to start your own companies?" 2 out of 3 hands shot up. Since then, thousands of companies, including Silicon Graphics, Oracle, and Cisco Systems, have popped up. The common theme of all these enterprises is the conviction that a great idea or innovative technology can make a difference. But there is something else that's needed if a great idea is to become the seed of a great business: collaboration. The quest for superb teams represents a modern grail of sorts for business. In the world today, there's plenty of technology, plenty of entrepreneurs, plenty of money, plenty of venture capital. What's in short supply is great teams. So says John Doerr, a legendary Silicon Valley venture capitalist who has backed industry-changing startups from Lotus and Compaq to Genentech and Netscape. Doerr's company, Kleiner, Perkins, Caulfield, and Byers, gets 2,500 business plans each year from hopeful entrepreneurs. Of these, they pick about 100 to consider seriously, and they invest in about 25. Says Doerr, "A team thinks it's selling us on the technology and the product or service, but actually we're thinking about them, the team members. We want to understand who they are, how they will work together." During his meetings with prospective startups, he probes the group's dynamic, how they might manage themselves, agree on priorities, measure whether they're doing their jobs well, handle someone who isn't working out. "I'm checking their instincts, their navigation system, their values." Crucial to such a team is the right mix of intelligence and expertise, or what Doerr calls really smart people. And though he doesn't use the phrase, emotional intelligence. Dorr cautions the two must be balanced, not all brilliance and experience, nor just drive, energy, and passion. Getting that mix right is the difference between ventures that achieve greatness and startups that are merely successful, or worse. Survival of the social. Humans are the primordial team players. Our uniquely complex social relationships have been a crucial survival advantage. Our extraordinarily sophisticated talent for cooperation culminates in the modern organization. Some evolutionary thinkers see the key moment for the emergence of interpersonal skill as the point when our ancestors moved from treetops to life on the broad savannas, when social coordination in hunting and gathering paid huge dividends. Learning the essential skills for survival meant children needed schooling in that critical period, up to age 15 or so, during which the human brain becomes anatomically mature. Cooperation provided this advantage, and with it came a complex social system and a new challenge to human intelligence. This view of the crucial role of cooperation in evolution is part of a radical rethinking of just what the famous phrase, survival of the fittest, means. In the late 19th century, social Darwinists seized on that phrase to argue that fitness meant the strong and ruthless would inevitably triumph over the weak. They used that as a rationale to celebrate unbridled competition and to ignore the plight of the poor and disenfranchised. Today, that idea has been overturned in evolutionary theory by the simple insight that evolutionary fitness is measured not by toughness, but by reproductive success. How many of one's children survive to pass on one's genes to future generations. That genetic legacy is the true sense of survival in evolution. From that perspective, the group working together, foraging for food, nurturing children, fending off predators, has been the key to human survival, not the ruthlessness of lone rogues. And indeed, Darwin himself first proposed that human groups whose members were ready to work together for the common good survived better and had more offspring than those whose members were self-serving or those who were not part of any group at all. Even today, the benefits of a close-knit band are evident in the few remaining human groups that subsist as hunters and gatherers, the mode of living throughout the millions of years during which our brain took on its present architecture. In such groups, one of the main determinants of children's health is whether they have a living grandmother or other elderly relative who can supplement the mother and father's efforts to garner food. One modern legacy of this past is the radar for friendliness and cooperation most of us have. People gravitate to those who show signs of these qualities. We also have a strong early warning system that alerts us to someone who may be selfish or untrustworthy. An experiment at Cornell University had groups of strangers mix and meet for 30 minutes, and then rate each other on how selfish or cooperative the others were. Those ratings held up when compared with how the people actually performed in a game where they could choose selfish or cooperative strategies for winning. Likewise, people are drawn to others who are as cooperative and friendly as they are. Groups made up of cooperative strangers are as altruistic and helpful to each other as are members of the same family. Socializing shapes the brain. One great anatomical legacy of the human need to band together is the neocortex, the brain's topmost layers, which gives us the capacity to think. The adaptive challenges that matter most to the survival of a species are what lead to evolutionary changes in that species. Operating in a coordinated band, whether it be a working corporate team or a roving group of proto-humans, demands a high level of social intelligence, skill in reading and handling relationships. If the more socially intelligent have the greatest number of surviving offspring, and therefore are the most fit, then nature would select for changes in the human brain that better handle the complexities of living in groups. In evolution, as today, group members had to balance the advantages of cooperation in fending off enemies, hunting and foraging, and caring for children, with the advantages of competition within the group for food, mates, or other limited resources, particularly in times of scarcity. Add to that having to compute hierarchies of dominance, social and kinship obligations, and quid pro quo exchanges, and the result was a staggeringly large amount of social data to track and use well. Therein lies the evolutionary pressure to develop a thinking brain, with the capacity to make all these social connections instantly. In the animal kingdom, only mammals have a neocortex at all. Among primates, including us humans, the ratio of neocortex to total brain volume